The motion, it's phrased in the programme as a question, but of course a motion is never a question, it's an assertion. So the motion is that building bigger and better climate change models is a poor investment. Proposing the motion will be Jonathan Nugé from the Department of Mathematics, University of Bristol, and opposing it will be Tim Palmer from the European Centre for Medium Range Weather Forecasts. I will try and keep things fairly balanced as best I can. So each of the major speakers will talk for around about 10 minutes, and then we'll open it up to the floor, and finally we'll allow about 5 minutes each for the speakers to respond to the points that have been made. I'm hoping, although we'll see how it goes, I'm hoping that there will be roughly equally balanced contributions from either side of the motion. If at all possible, I'd like to try and alternate contributions from the floor to go one side and then the other, but that may not be possible, we'll see how it goes. But ideally, if we've just had a speaker from one side and you've got a point away from the other side, then way frankly, you may be given preference. We do have a limited time because Lord Krebs will be waiting to give us a talk in the Millane Lecture Room until 5:30, and we mustn't be late. So without more ado, we'll get going, and I'll introduce John Urige, who will propose the motion that building bigger and better climate change models is a poor investment.
Thank you, Phil. Good afternoon, everybody. So my name is John Urige. I'm a statistician in the Maths Department at the University of Bristol. I study the assessment and quantification of uncertainty in complex systems, and I've been working with climate scientists for about 10 years. So I'm proposing the motion that building bigger and better climate models is a poor investment. My position is that we need more investment in climate science, but that building bigger climate models is a poor investment compared to the alternative, which I'll describe in this 10 minutes. Okay? I think the key thing to understand, and this is something that Mike Hume discussed last night as well, is that in climate science we can distinguish between what we might call academic climate science on the one hand and policy climate science on the other. Okay? Those are two different things, and they both have their place, but obvious difficulties arise when research funders think they're paying for policy climate science and they actually get academic climate science. And this is really what I want to talk about, and bigger climate simulators are at the heart of the issue. Now, academic climate science is about understanding how the large-scale regularities that we see in the weather, particularly the mean or average weather, emerge as the result of microscale processes in the atmosphere and oceans. Okay? And climate simulators, based upon these processes, these microscale principles, can be used to demonstrate through computation, the emergence of the large-scale regularities. Okay? This requires a big climate simulator with a high resolution in space and time. Okay? These simulators are known as general circulation models, or GCMs. That's what we mean by a big climate model. Okay? And there have been some notable successes with GCMs. The latest generation of GCMs have really aided our understanding of phenomena, coupled ocean-atmosphere phenomena, like the El Niño-Southern Oscillation, for example, and the way that ENSO, as it's known, has a planetary-wide impact, particularly in mean weather. Okay? And there are also some problems with the current generation of GCMs. They don't do a very good job at the moment of representing the intertropical convergence zone, and there are a number of other features too. It's thought that building yet bigger GCMs with yet higher spatial and temporal resolution will resolve some of these problems. Okay? Now, academic climate science is really a fascinating area, and someone more knowledgeable than myself, Professor Tim Palmer, for example, would keep you spellbound for hours, telling you about climate simulators, what they can and can't do, and why they can't do it, and what that tells us about the climate system. Okay? That's academic climate science. For policy climate science, however, the focus is fundamentally different. Okay? Policy climate science is really about the distribution of weather, and for policy, it's the distribution of future weather. Okay? This focus on the whole distribution is a really a key thing to understand, and the reason that we have to focus on the whole distribution is because humans are affected by extremes. Right? We're affected directly, for example, by heat waves, but we're also affected indirectly by the effect of extreme weather on our infrastructure and our environment and the environmental services that we derive, like food and water. Okay? So understanding the distribution of weather, especially the tails of that distribution, is crucial in policy climate science. Okay? Now, if you want to make a prediction for the distribution of future weather, you really have to go through three stages. The first stage is you have to think about the distribution of weather within your GCM. So you have a particular GCM. It might be, you know, the big climate model at the Hadley Centre, for example. What you can do is you can take that GCM and you can run it for a number of different initial conditions. Right? And that's because weather is really a manifestation of the chaotic nature of the underlying equations in your model. Okay? It's rather like going to work. If I set off to work each morning, and every time I go to work, I go to work in a slightly, subtly different way, then when I've gone to work a lot of times, I'll have built up a distribution, right, for the time it takes me to get to work. Okay? And it's the same thing with the GCM. So you need to do multiple runs at different initial conditions to get a feeling for the weather inside your GCM. The second thing we have to do is we have to account for the limitations of our GCMs. Okay? For all the progress that's been made in the last 20 years, and there has been a huge amount of progress, right, a GCM still provides a very limited representation of a system as complex as climate. Okay? This is not going to change in the foreseeable future, right, unless there's a total revolution in computing technology. So to capture the effect of these limitations on uncertainty, we need to repeat the weather calculation that I described in the first stage, right, many times. And this repetition is across all the versions of the GCM that are consistent with our understanding of the dynamics and the physics of climate. For any given GCM, there's actually a huge number of versions that would be consistent in this way. Okay, so this second stage requires a lot of work. The third stage is we also have to account for the uncertainty that we have about the future. This is typically represented by alternative scenarios. So we need to repeat the first two stages, that's weather within the GCM, and then across all versions of the GCM, right, for each of the future scenarios that we can envisage. Now, the latest thinking proposes four representative concentration pathways for the future, so that would be maybe possibly four future scenarios. Okay? So, repeated runs of a GCM for different initial conditions, for different versions, and over different future scenarios would be loosely termed replications in statistics, and that's the word that I'll use here. Now, I've done a back-of-the-envelope calculation to work out how many GCM replications we might need to estimate a distribution for future weather in, say, 2070. Okay? So as a gross approximation, and this is obviously a very gross approximation, my guess is we might need about 1,000, okay, given the size of the problem and given the fact that we want to estimate tails, and tails are hard to estimate. Okay? Actually, I think the crude number is probably much larger. It's probably maybe 10 or 100 times larger. But I'm going to assume that we can reduce it to 1,000 by careful use of sequential experimental design. Now, experimental design is something that statisticians have studied for nearly 100 years. It's had a really profound effect in fields like agriculture, engineering, and medicine. In the last 20 years, there's been a development of additional understanding for how we do computer experiments. And what I'm describing with the GCM is exactly what we mean by a computer experiment. So there's a huge amount of useful information in the stats community about how we might do these experiments, but to my knowledge, it's not yet been incorporated into how we do climate science. I think that's going to change, but that's the situation at the moment. So, assuming we can get down to 1,000 replications, how long does it take to do them? So GCMs currently run on the Met Office supercomputers at about 100 simulation years per calendar month. Now, if we assume that we can run them in batches, parallel batches of 10 on the supercomputers without actually interfering or compromising the weather predictions, which are also done on the same computers, then this experiment is going to take about 12 years. Okay? So 12 years is quite a long time to wait, right, if you need to make a policy decision about, for example, the Thames Barrier. So how can we get that down? Well, I think if we put three things together, we can get it down quite substantially. If we assume, one, that Moore's law continues to hold, that is, computers double in power roughly every 2 years, okay, and, two, the Met Office gets a new supercomputer every 3 years, Okay, we can but hope. And crucially, three, there is no increase in GCM resolution. Right, that's crucial. Then we can get this down to about 7 years. Okay, now I should say that we're not starting from scratch with this experiment. Many parts of it are already in place, and UK climate scientists have been at the forefront of this effort, particularly climate scientists working as part of, at the Hadley Centre as part of the UK SIP project. So my case in a nutshell is that bigger climate simulators, right, are better for academic climate science, but more replications, right, are better for policy climate science. Right? This is because it's a basic principle, right, that replications are necessary to quantify uncertainty. Yep? And there is a lot of uncertainty about future weather. Okay? So to return to my original point, science funders have to be clear about what type of climate science they want. Okay? To make a policy case for bigger GCMs, that is higher resolution GCMs, it must be shown, this is for a policy case, it must be shown that they lead to an improved assessment of uncertainty. Yeah? Particularly in the tails of the weather distribution. And this improved assessment of uncertainty has to be despite the fact that their higher computational cost means lower replications. Okay? Now, as far as I know, that case for bigger GCMs has not yet been made. Okay? So I would certainly support more investment in climate science, but I don't think that bigger GCMs are the right investment for policy climate science, particularly when there's a pressing need for policy decisions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, John T. So now to oppose the motion, Tim Palmer.
I'm going to show a few slides to try and make my point. I guess I would call myself a physicist, perhaps a mathematical physicist, so I'm going to try and discuss some of the issues to do with climate prediction from a physical perspective. I'm going to start with a couple of animations of what the atmosphere looks like, from space. If I can find, there we go. So these are just animations of looking down from space. The first one shows the weather system. Well, first of all, it shows how complicated the atmosphere is, how turbulent and kind of chaotic it is. We can also see the mid-latitude weather systems. UK's up in the top right there, which bring our weather. These weather systems have about scales of maybe 1,000 kilometres. They play an important thermodynamic role in transporting heat from the sun, which is primarily absorbed in tropical latitudes, transporting that north. So we wouldn't be nearly as warm as we are without these weather patterns. They play an important dynamical role in determining the thermal structure of the atmosphere. Here's another animation from space, but now we're looking at this doesn't seem to want to work.
Tim, can you just clarify, are these actual...
These are real, this is the real world. This is real images from satellites. Not simulations, this is the real world. For some reason my laptop has decided to give up the ghost. All right, that's a shame. What these are showing, okay, it's another type of weather system which is very prevalent in the tropics, which are thunderstorms bubbling up from the surface. I don't know why this is performing badly, but it should have been a nice animation. Bubbling up from the surface. These thunderstorms have scales of only a few kilometres, typically, but they're crucially important in determining how heat, which is absorbed at the surface, is transported vertically. Not only heat, but also moisture, which ultimately gives rise to the cloudiness that we see in the atmosphere. So two types of key types of weather phenomenon. By the way, you see two nice tropical cyclones spinning up from those thunderstorm clouds and moving up over towards Japan and that area. Okay. I don't know why I'm having so much trouble here. This is not normal. Okay. Right. So, we try to describe climate using mathematical models, and these vary from very, very simple models to what I'll show you in a minute, very, very complex models, sort of things Jean T was talking about. This is a very simple model. You could solve this with a pocket calculator. It says, F sun, if you've got a certain amount of energy from the sun coming into the Earth, a certain amount is reflected back into space. So typically A might be a third, roughly, the albedo of the Earth. And the Earth comes into equilibrium with that by warming up, has a certain temperature. It radiates what's called blackbody radiation with the famous fourth power. That's the equilibrium temperature it attains to be in balance with the energy it's getting from the sun. And we can estimate, you know, the temperature of the Earth from that equation. As I say, if you've got a pocket calculator that does fourth roots, very simple, and that's fine. The problem is that sort of equation and any simplified types of equations are pretty useless at predicting how important the climate change problem is going to be. Because, for example, we know that one of the most critical issues in understanding climate change is how the clouds that I showed you in the first slides, amplify the greenhouse warming signal. What is the magnitude of that feedback between increasing carbon dioxide and changing levels of clouds? So you can't just have a parameter for clouds. I haven't explained. Of course, the albedo is strongly determined by how cloudy the atmosphere is. A lot of the reflectance of solar energy back into space is by clouds. So we need to represent the clouds, the albedo, in a more dynamic way than can possibly be done with that equation. So then we're led to really what are very complex equations. So this is the famous Navier-Stokes equations, which governs how fluids evolve, whether it's the atmosphere, the oceans, or just motion in a cup of coffee or something. Now, this looks beguilingly simple, actually, in some sense. I mean, I've represented that equation in less than, well, around 20 mathematical symbols. But its kind of complexity is hidden. And I like to use this analogy with a Russian doll, because a Russian doll at one level looks rather simple and uncomplicated. But, of course, Russian dolls unpack into many Russian dolls. And similarly, the Navier-Stokes equations actually unpack. And this is the power of mathematics, in some sense, that you can describe with this relatively simple equation, what seems to be simple equation, what actually is shorthand for billions and billions and billions of equations. And so there's a very close analogy here between the Russian doll unpacking and these equations unpacking. And in this analogy, then, the Navier-Stokes equations would describe motions from tens of thousands of kilometres in the atmosphere down to submillimeter scales. And the problem is our computers are just not big enough to describe all that complexity, so we have to approximate, we have to throw away a number of Russian dolls if we're ever to solve this equation on our computers, and what we do is actually approximate scales that we can't resolve properly with rather crude formula, crude compared to the beauty of the Navier-Stokes equations themselves. And typical climate models have truncation scales around 100 kilometres at present. And the point about that 100 kilometres is it is much greater than the scale of those crucial deep convective, those thunderstorm clouds in the tropics, which I'm claiming play a really crucial role in determining the three-dimensional thermal structure of the atmosphere. So the situation is, here's a picture again from space. This is really what it looks like in a climate model. It's much coarser because we can't resolve the detail because the computers aren't big enough. I want to give you an analogy. Suppose you're given a piece of text which is rather blurred. Okay, what you might do is take out potential words you might think might be interesting and give them to some image processing company who puts super algorithms at work to try and find out exactly what those words were. This is a bit like what we do in climate modelling. We have these so-called downscaling processes which try to take little bits, maybe bits over the UK, and bash away at them to try and get more detail. So we do that, and a few words come out, and it looks like it's a text about the weather at different times of year, maybe. But, you know, let me say, is this really a good thing to do? Maybe we should just go back to the publishers and say, for God's sake, print this damn thing at a decent resolution, I can read it. And if you do that, then you see, actually, the big picture wasn't about weather at all. It's a love poem. It's the most famous love poem in the English language. So the point is, we've completely missed the big picture by this image processing type of approach. So it is pretty crucial, I think, that we do represent these Navier-Stokes equations as accurately as possible. And I would like to say, to perhaps slightly contradict Jonty, that these really are designed to be policy-relevant models. These are not academic models. These are policy-relevant models. And they're relevant in three different areas. One is in guiding mitigation treaties. And this is from the IPCC fourth assessment. So this shows, what this shows is actually the range of uncertainty that we currently have because of these rather coarse truncations in our models. This shows different warmings with different CO2 scenarios, but these show the uncertainties due to this problem of having to truncate these Russian dolls at such crude resolutions. Okay, secondly, these models are used to inform adaptation policy at a much more regional level. How are we going to, if we can't cut emissions by the amount we want, we're going to have to adapt. But what are we adapting to? We don't want to spend millions or billions maladapting, so we have to be pretty certain what the change in climate is regionally. And again, this is where having accurate representations or solutions of Navier-Stokes is crucial. And finally, I think we heard in the last talk before tea, is it, or the one before that, about these alternative geoengineering possible solutions. So spray salt into the air to increase the reflectivity of clouds. Okay, you can look at that energy balance model and say, okay, if I increase the albedo, there's less energy coming in, that may offset global warming due to CO2. But crucially, would we really do this if we didn't understand whether we were going to, say, cause the monsoons to shut off or lead to permanent anticyclonic conditions over Europe or do something terrible at a regional level? We've got to have these accurate Navier-Stokes solvers to have any confidence at all in knowing whether these types of proposals are things we really want to take seriously or not. So I'm going to be slightly more radical than Jonty. He says, well, we need to ensure the Met Office gets continued funding for its computers, and I wouldn't disagree with that. But I would like to propose that we often come together as a community internationally to solve problems that can't be solved at a national level. The Large Hadron Collider is one obvious example. The Nuclear Fusion ITER Center is another. Astronomy has many examples, and there are other areas in science where solving problems internationally that can't be solved nationally is a good way forward. And I think this is an ideal problem that should be tackled internationally. It's not currently, for a number of reasons, but I think we can actually achieve both Jonty's goal of multiple realizations and my goal of getting towards the types of resolutions that can get down to these convective scales, the 1 kilometer scales, by actually coming together at an international level. The cost would be less than it takes to typically put up a satellite mission into space, so it's not a fantastically expensive thing, given if you believe that having accurate climate predictions is important for policy types of issues. I would say, as sort of proof of concept, if you like, that in weather prediction, which is verifiable, the problem with climate change prediction is we have to wait until it happens to know whether our predictions were right or not. But in weather prediction, we can verify things pretty much, the next day or the next week. And over the last few decades, one quite clearly quantifiable, thing is that putting in high-resolution models, because in weather prediction, we don't have to make a 100-year prediction, we only have to do it for the next day or the next few days. So the computational demands of running a model at 10 or 1 kilometres is not as great as for climate. And we can show objectively that has led to improvements in skill. So I would just conclude that we really should, in fact I can't really see a case that we shouldn't continue to invest because it's such a crucial problem. But my paradigm is a little bit different to Jonty's. We should think more boldly than just keeping the Met Office going and think at a much more international level to solve this problem. Thank you.
Floor discussion. We are being videotaped, so anybody who speaks will please be asked to speak into this microphone. Ideally, I would now like a seconder of the motion.
Yes.
I will second the second motion, Alice Hughes University.
There's only one motion, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm going to go against the motion that was put forward.
Can we get to you after somebody who will be in favour of the motion that we do not need bigger and better climate model? Right? Everybody, please announce who you are before you
start. I'm Steve Rayner. I'm the director of the Institute for Science, Innovation Society, Oxford University. I was a lead author on the IPCC third and fourth assessment reports. I want to second the motion, but I actually want to second it in a much more radical form than the proposer, which is I would like to suggest that in fact the state of climate science has been sufficiently robust for sound policy since 1992, and that improvements in the science since then have actually done very little, if anything, to improve the formulation of policy. That in fact the models that are used to the idea that we need to have much more accurate models to inform emissions reduction treaties and adaptation assume a benefit cost and analytic framework, that in fact we can figure out what the costs or potential damages of climate change are going to be and construct a damage curve. We can then construct mitigation cost curves or adaptation cost curves, and the point at which those cost curves intersect is the level at which you intervene with policy, and that will shape your expenditure. And what I want to suggest is that even if we could get the improvements that are being suggested in the climate models, there are still so many other layers of uncertainty in terms of what that more certain climate information would imply for natural systems, for ecosystems, for social systems, for the economy, so on and so forth, that you would still be a long way away from being able to construct realistic damage cost curves or mitigation or adaptation cost curves. So what I'm suggesting is that, in fact, even if you can resolve the climate uncertainty as being suggested, the complexity and the indeterminacy of the total world system, including the issues of working with the question of trade system, the economic system, and so on, are such that you could not possibly construct these cost curves on anything like a practical timescale that would correspond to giving us a chance at actually stabilising the atmosphere at anything like 2 degrees by mid-century. And that therefore I think we should say to the climate scientists, you've done a wonderful job of sounding the early warning to society. Society has been slow and stumbling in its responses. Thank you very much. We should give you guys shed loads of money to go back and play with the models for the sake of good science. But actually the policy development is not dependent on getting any more certain resolution about the scientific dimensions. We are now faced with a societal strategic choice about how to respond to climate change, and we should be thinking strategic terms about it, not benefit cost terms. Finer-grained science will not, grainy grains make finer flour, finer-grained science will not make better climate policy. Thank you.
Very much. On the baton.
Alice Hughes, University of Bristol. I will argue against the motion because I'm someone who studies other species, looking at biodiversity and the effects of climate change into the future. Now, most species do not exist and move on scales of hundreds of kilometres, though they might in the past have shown adaptive responses of moving in response to climate change. They can't do that because of habitat fragmentation now. If we don't have high-resolution models, how do we know where to focus conservation and research efforts when we're looking at trying to preserve biodiversity? Where do we build our corridors of rainforest? Where are important to focus those conservation efforts? We're one species among millions, and if we want effectively conserve biodiversity, we need high-resolution, fine-grained models, because ones of 100 kilometres just aren't applicable to species that show small-scale distributions and can't show responses in terms of hundreds of kilometres.
Thank you very much. Do we have anyone now? Kevin, for the motion.
Hello, I'm Kevin McConway. I'm a statistician. I work at the Open University. I can't claim to have any major expertise in climate science or atmospheric science, though I have been present at more than one debate of this general nature, and I'll make some general points about that. I should say before, though, in direct response to the previous speaker, that I do work with plant ecologists on similar questions, except they're transplanted animals, on that sort of fine scale. And I'd like to clear up what I think is a misunderstanding that the last speaker may have had about the nature of the resolution of these models. I think we have to think back to what John Tenuggia was saying at the beginning, that if we're talking about climate, we need to look at averages, we need to look at distributions, and using a model which works on a very fine scale doesn't necessarily mean that the climate predictions will vary on the same fine scale. They're still likely to be averaged, to be work over a broader scale, and essentially not to deal with the problem you've raised, which I know from my own work is terribly important, but I think if we had a model which consisted of the Earth out there, the spare Earth that we kind of work on, it still wouldn't solve the problem that both you and I have got in our practice of work. But to get back to the more general issue, what has always struck me when I've been present in debates of this sort is what it seems to me to be a lack of shared understanding between statisticians on the one hand and physicists on the other hand about what a model actually is. The impression I get is that physicists' ideal would be, as I mentioned before, a model which consists of a spare Earth, which might run a bit faster, and which we can try things out on. Now, there are a lot of applications of models in statistics where one can obtain better estimates of aggregate behavior, better estimates of what goes on in the tails from a model which all concerned agree matches reality rather less well than another model. That's partly to do with the number of replications you can run. It's partly to do with aspects of overfitting because the model is not the world. And the aim of a statistician in doing this modeling is not to replicate the world, not to come up with something which exactly matches what's going on, but to come up with something which is tuned to produce the best predictions of the type of prediction that you actually want. And I would like to hear some convincing arguments that increasing the resolution of the model will improve the accuracy of the predictions of what's going on in the tails of these distributions. I don't think that can be taken for granted. It might be the case, it might not be the case. And likewise, I would like to hear a justification for the point that the proposer made, that these higher resolution models work better at predicting the weather, and therefore they will work better in predicting the climate. I think that's an assumption which, again, may or may not be true, but I don't think it is obviously true. I don't think it could be said without question.
Thank you very much. Anybody else on the other side?
I'm David Wallace. I'm director at the Newton Institute, where there currently is a programme on climate change where I would say that Tim and Jonty are actually working together, so it's okay, really. And my background is that I was in physics. I did a lot of modelling, and about 30 years ago I started out on high-performance computing, which included actually in our centre doing a bit of the early work for the parallelisation, that is making it fit for the new high-end computers of the Met Office code. But I don't know anything in detail. However, I have an instinct about things which might or might not be relevant for the last point. So on the whole, I'm wanting indeed to argue against the motion. But my point is roughly, in all my instincts are, in fact, if you're going to capture the extreme events, then you need the high resolution at the extreme events. I don't know any detail about this, but that's what all my physics background suggests. Because they're localized in space, they're tropical storms, and they're localized in time, and you need the high resolution actually for the extreme events, which are going to be the important objects, like the catastrophic storms or whatever, and therefore in the tail of the distributions. So my argument would be that both people are right, and you'd be back. You do need the high-end computers. I bet I didn't get my job without putting oil in troubled waters. The only other comment I would make is, and I don't know if this should be recorded or not, anyway, it's about the importance of algorithms. These haven't been really mentioned by either, and it's not just an issue of the increase in computer power, which naturally takes place, but you can get orders of magnitude improvement when you understand how to write the mathematics in a better way for the computer. So I'm optimistic as well that the aspirations of both will actually be met.
Thank you. Somebody for the motion, I trust?
In the hand of France Scientific National Fine Reserve. But I wonder, nobody mentioned the fact that we saw the rise of the question of living matter, which entered in the models of climate, and the transformation of some of these models are not only the property of physics and atmospheric science, but also now the importance of surface models of vegetation and CO2 cycles and so on, geophysical and bio. So we cannot say that the science in a whole can stop now, even if we agree with the position of our colleague that we know enough to want some volunteer climate policies and so on. But that doesn't mean that science is enough, and we know all about the climate model.
Yes. Okay.
Hello, I'm Ken Milne from the Met Office, and I come to this problem not as a climate modeler in the Met Office, but as a working in weather forecasting problem, and therefore used to using higher resolution versions of what in the Met Office is the same model. We use the same unified model for both climate change and weather prediction, but generally speaking, for weather forecasting, we run at much higher resolution. And what I do in my work is use the same sort of ideas Jonty was talking about, multiple runs of the model to try and understand the uncertainty in the weather forecast, which Tim, in fact, has been heavily involved in at ECWF as well. And one of the issues is that I know from that experience is that if you want to predict the tails of distribution, you want to understand the risks of more extreme events, you can only do so if you have a model which is capable of resolving those more extreme events. To resolve those more extreme events, you need to have the extra resolution, higher detail in the model. And this comes right back to the problem of climate change, where some even of the large-scale circulation processes in the atmosphere can't be properly resolved and represented if you don't have this proper resolution in the model. So, for example, the climate in Europe is often affected by a process called blocking, which where one gets formations, atmospheric formations in the Atlantic Ocean, which prevents the transition of low pressure systems across the Atlantic. These long periods of high pressure, for example, which have a major impact on the climate. And those can't be very well resolved, particularly the transition in and out of blocking, by low resolution models. So to get that's a representation of climatology better, we need to have higher resolution. So I don't think we could run any number of large replications, as John is suggesting. If you run it with a low resolution model, those replications still won't give you the tails of distribution correctly. So in principle, yes, I think we have to go for the higher resolution models if we're going to improve the predictions. I think Tim's aim of getting to kilometer scale models for the climate and running multiple resolutions is a long, long way off because the computing demands are staggering. But I think we have to come down that side of the debate.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I'm on the appropriate side.
David Newman. One problem with debates is you tend to be limited to either yes or no and don't think of different options. One thing in Northern Ireland we learned is you actually want to find consensus. You generate half a dozen or a dozen options and then get people to rank them, add up the points, and you find out where the consensus is. So I'd like to throw in a couple more alternatives in addition to the two explicit and two implicit ones you've had so far. So far we've got more detailed, finer-grained models. We've got replicating the same one by more different people. We've got the implicit do-nothing. and we've got stuff on weather models. But suppose the problem isn't actually the model itself, but people's understanding and trust in the models. Then you might build a computer game like SimCity, so lots of people, including skeptics, can play around with it and learn what climate modelling is really like. With simplified models. So you get some practice at that and get a feeling for that. Or suppose, and the mass might not work this way, but you might use a sort of point setting thing to get distributed, everyone using their computers doing to it, so not some strange scientist. But I myself get part of it, so where should I trust them? Or you might say, let's have an open source climate modelling thing, big problem there with the resources, and get the skeptics to try and build their own models. That's just three more alternatives. I'm sure there are other types of modelling or different directions people might think.
Yes, hello, Matisse from Mainz University. I'm pretty much in favor of the notion. I still have a problem or something to elaborate with, which is the idea of the separation between academic science and policy climate science, and where you draw the line, and does not the one influence the other, and vice versa. I think we should elaborate a little bit more about this, or we can then say more money into academic science and less into policy climate science.
My name is Chris Jones. I'm a mathematician from the University of Warwick. I want to speak for the motion. I'm also a participant in the Newton Institute program that's currently going on. I actually live somewhere between the two, but I think there is a real problem with putting all of the investment into higher resolution models, which I think is the tendency right now. And so I want to argue with Jonty's side. I mean, I think we've gotten to the point where if we think of the best climate models as being effectively those that we cannot calibrate, because if we could spend time properly calibrating them and judging their uncertainty, then people would say, well, you could have spent that energy, that investment in going to higher resolution so you don't have the best models. And I think that's a serious problem. I'd like to look at that problem a bit in terms of what I thought was Tim's quite powerful analogy of the Shakespeare love poem, and suggest that your picking of the words in that poem was not random. I suspect you looked at the poem ahead of time and knew which words to pick out, which would have been misleading. Right? If you take Jonty's position and you imagine doing that experiment further, presumably you would take a number of random picks of words, and I think you would quite quickly figure out that that was Shakespeare's love poem. Now, one could come back and say, well, that's actually something that is already there. Basically, you're exhibiting a bias, and that is always there in when you approach these the information that you have. And so the question is whether you resolve that bias by going to higher resolution or whether you resolve that bias by doing more replications. And I don't think that we know the answer to that. It could go either way, and I suspect that we need to do both, and we need to have a balanced investment in them. But right now, the investment is largely focused in the higher resolution, so I think we're better off going in Jonty's direction.
Yes.
Yeah.
Emily Shepherd from the British Antarctic Survey. I'm not quite sure whether I agree or disagree with the motion in the first place. I've slightly lost track of which one's which anyway. But one thing I think that came out of both presentations was the desire to be motivated by informing policy. But as Tim sort of alluded to slightly in his presentation, there are a number of different policies which you might want to provide information. And the answer to the question may be somewhat different according to which particular policy you're talking about. So just in terms, take one of those policies, which was mentioned at the beginning which would be an international mitigation policy, and there was an argument that was provided that essentially, in terms of that, the science is in, and from now on there's other other criteria which will determine what is done in terms of international mitigation policy. But on that, there is one aspect that potentially could be a game changer in terms of international policy and in terms of model development, and that concerns the potential non-linearities in the system. We know that climate has changed dramatically in the past in ways which aren't properly represented in the models. And so in that sense, if nothing else, there is a continued need for development of models for informing international policy of that nature. And there are, of course, many other different policies which are also important and might require some different approach, including informing adaptation strategies. But I think it's just important to be clear that there isn't just one catch-all in terms of policy.
Thank you.
We've
got time for perhaps one more question.
I'm James Allen, and I'm working in Japan. I suspect that the siren calls for faster computers and higher resolution have been around for as long as computers and models have been around. But empirically, it seems to me the evidence is that this improvement in computing performance and resolution hasn't led to any real convergence among model predictions. Certainly the models get more realistic in some ways, they get lots of truth there in terms of how the output looks. But the range of model results doesn't seem to have changed. And those people who went to work Hume's talk yesterday would have seen a prediction made 20 years ago by one of the first coupled atmosphere ocean models, and it wouldn't have had a place today. So my point is that the improvement that the people promised based on going to a big computer is perhaps rather illusory.
Okay, sorry we don't have time for any more contributions from the floor. I will now get back to the speakers. So I think Tim, maybe you could spend 3 minutes summing up.
I think what I'd rather than sum up, I'd just rather try and address some of the issues which were mentioned.
Steve talked about finer grains not making better science. I just wanted to be clear about one thing.
Better policy.
The drive for this high resolution, which I, by the way, see as being able to represent the laws of physics more accurately, that's basically what it's about, is not just to get more detail, important as that is, and as the lady was talking about ecosystems and so on, that's important, but it's also to get about the largest scales. The system is non-linear, so if you get the small scales right, that actually influences the large scales as well. And for example, colleagues at Oxford, Steve will know this result from the climateprediction.net group, who were able to run very large ensembles with distributed PCs. Just by slightly changing one of the parameters in my rusty tin can set of parameters, the things where your subgrid, so you're no longer representing Navier-Stokes properly, you have these approximate formula. Changing one of these parameters just by a relatively small amount changed the global warming, the so-called climate sensitivity, from 3 degrees up to 12 degrees. Now, it's utterly unsatisfactory to have a climate simulation capability that is so dependent on the precise values of these parameters, which themselves are not proper representations of the laws of physics. So I find that unsatisfactory. But also, from Steve's point of view, I come back to my issue about geoengineering. The current generation of climate models does not simulate monsoons very accurately. Monsoons are actually incredibly complicated systems. Would you really trust a prediction of the impact of increasing stratospheric aerosols on the monsoon rainfall if you knew that that signal was as large as the biases that the models have in simulating monsoons in the first place? I think nobody in their right minds would. You can't trust a prediction that's the same magnitude as the bias in the model. So we have to do something about that. Now, I take issue with people that say we've been working for years, we've increased model resolution, and we don't have much impact to show for it. It's not actually the case. In climate, the priority over the last 20 or more years has not been in resolution. It's been in increasing the complexity of models in terms of processes like oceans, biogeochemistry, cryosphere, and other things. Important as they are, resolution has not been a high priority. The reason for that is, if you increase the resolution by a factor of 2, it takes a factor of 2 to the power 4, typically, more computer time, 4 being the dimension of space and time. So it's quite a costly thing to do that. But I come back to Ken Milne's point about, you know, it's going to take a long time. It won't take a long time if we make the point that this is, to quote David King, the most important, urgent problem facing humanity. Why can't we have dedicated access to the sort of computers that are used for defence and national security purposes? When Ken talks about computers, he's talking about the sort of computers the UK government funds the Met Office for. He's not talking about the number. In fact, it's not even number one. The top computers in the world are not specified in the top 100 because they're for national security and defence purposes, and they're not listed because that's a secure piece of information. Why isn't it climate can't have access to that type of computational speed? I think these problems could be solved quite easily if we made a much more powerful case for the need for these. And it doesn't diminish in any way John T's points, and I myself work on ensemble forecasting as well, so I know all and I appreciate all the points he's made. But actually, you know, ensemble forecasting is a trivial matter. If you have a computer that can run at high resolution, because it'll be, you know, this is just an issue now about parallel processing. Running multiple realizations is actually fairly straightforward. It's getting down to the high resolution that's the complicated part. I just want to finish, well, I've got 1 minute, something I've not done before, but I wrote a science fiction story which is appearing in next month's, those who get it, Bulletin of the American Meteorological Society. And the reason I'm going to tell you about this is that it illustrates this point about getting the tales of the distribution right. And I was inspired by a short story I read when I was a kid called Nightfall by Isaac Asimov. And those of you who've read it will know this, but in that story, there's a planet that orbits around... Well, it's one of... there are 6 suns that orbit around each other, and the planet orbits around one of these suns. And once every 1,000 years or more, maybe... all the suns are below the horizon and they see the night sky for the first time. And when this happens, they go mad because nobody has warned them of the kind of the fact they live in this enormous universe. Suddenly, my God, we're just an insignificant part of a big cosmos. All right, so I tried to build on that. And imagine now one of these, this planet orbiting around a sun with a rather kind of sort of perpetual winter climate, a really cold and miserable climate. And all of a sudden, due to the kind of chaotic motion of these stars, suddenly the planet gets captured by the gravitational field of a different star. And now it starts to orbit around this star much more closely than it did to the old one. So it suddenly has gone from this perpetual winter to perpetual summer. And the astronomers know about this. They can predict a year or several years ahead. They know this is going to happen. So it's down to the climatologist to predict how the climate will change and how the society should adapt to the climate change. And they have these IPCC-type models to make their judgments about what to do. And they say, this is going to be fantastic. It's going to get 10 degrees warmer. We're going to live fantastic lives. You know, we don't need... There'll be a bit of sea level rise, so we better move uphill a bit. Apart from that, it's going to be fantastic. And of course, what happens is they live in a part of the world where after a few years, the oceans start to warm and these hurricanes develop. And the hurricanes spin in and they completely destroy the civilization's these flimsy houses, which were just now, you know, I'm told to shut up, taking the wonderful heat. So this is an example of where, you know, with their models, they could have... The point being that IPCC models can't simulate hurricanes. You know, you wouldn't blow over a pack of cars with an IPCC-class hurricane. So you can vary parameters to your soul's content. You will never get a hurricane out of an IPCC-class model. And so, you know, using these models to adapt to this climate change would have been an utterly disastrous thing to have done. And of course, if they'd had these models, then they would have known, okay, just move a few hundred kilometres inland and it won't be nearly so bad. So that was my science fiction story, just to illustrate the dangers of making policy relevant judgments about with what I think are our current inadequate class of climate models.
I can tell that. The last word goes to John.
I'm quite pragmatic about the situation in climate science, and I'm very much addressing the question of where we go from where we are right now. I want to make it clear that I do believe that going to higher resolution will improve the physics in the models. I believe that very strongly, and I think there's lots of evidence to suggest that's true. But I think we have to realise that going to higher resolution has a huge setup cost, first of all. You have to write the new code, and then you have to tune it. Yep, because you can't use the parameters you had in the old model because the resolution has changed and the parameters are tuning resolution dependent. So that could take a year, and there's well-documented situations where you go to higher resolution and then the model performs worse because you have to fiddle with the tuning. So if we imagine, though, that the Moore's law holds and that we have 10 years, we can get the length scales of our climate models, right? If we spend all our money on resolution and we solve the tuning problem, we can get them down from about 200 kilometres to 100 kilometres. Okay? So the question is that a good improvement, right, in, for example, representing the tails of the weather distribution? Now, there's some physics with length scales between 100 and 200 kilometres, so that's now in. Okay, that's good. But we're still missing all the physics with length scales from 100 kilometres to zero. Okay? Now, frankly, that's most of the physics. Okay, that's turbulent mixing, that's convection schemes, that's the ocean-atmosphere interaction, that's the behaviour of sea ice. I mean, those are the things that are really important, and we're still not going to get them if Moore's law holds and we wait for 10 years and we get new supercomputers. So pragmatically, what do we do? Right, we're not going to be able to solve the problem by going from 200 kilometres resolution to 100 kilometres resolution. If we want to think about uncertainty, we have to think about distributions, but we have to think about spending the money on replications and not on resolution or on new processes. And that's the only point I want to make.
Thank you very much, Johnsy. Thank you, Tim. Thank you to everybody who's spoken. But don't go away. We've had a motion. And therefore, we have to have a vote. I won't count, but it's just a show of hands. So all those who will agree with the motion that building bigger and better climate change models is a poor investment, and those who will oppose that motion, at an estimate, it's very close. I think the motion just about has it by a whisker, but you won't.
Yeah, high resolution, man.
So thanks once again to everybody. We